Today on Vox Talks Economics, Trump, trade, and AI growth. Welcome to another of our special episodes recorded at the CEPR Annual Symposium in Paris. My name is Tim Phillips. The Trump administration says it wants America to lead in AI. But what does that mean in practice for trade and productivity? Gary Gensler of MIT and CEPR, and also, of course, a former chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission, joined me to unpack the administration's AI action plan, work out what's happening to export controls, and untangle the deal-making geopolitics of AI hardware. We also discussed whether AI will make growth great again, or just inflate a short-term capital spending boom. So Gary, welcome.
It's good to be with you, Tim.
We spend a lot of time talking about AI, the impact it's going to have on productivity, on the economy, but in policy terms, has the Trump administration made big moves on regulating AI?
Tim, let me just start by saying, I do believe that artificial intelligence is a transformative general purpose technology, but it's not new. Some of the first seminal work was around when I was born, and I'm not the youngest dude around any longer. But particularly the last 15 years, it's widely adopted in finance and in parts of the economy, the streaming apps like Netflix and all the big tech companies. And my gosh, even the Postal Service is using it to—
Postal Service?
Yes. You would think, no, they can't be, but just to figure out our handwriting. But of course, all the buzz is about generative AI in these last 2 or 3 years. And will it take all our jobs away or lead to some version of dystopian futures? But back to the question you asked. It's interesting. U.S. policy prior to Donald Trump taking his second term was pretty forward-leaning towards the continued development, and I stress continued development, of artificial intelligence. We did not have any national law like in the European context where they passed the EU AI Act, have some smattering of domestic state laws around privacy, about fake intimate pictures of any of us. I think that's a good thing that there's laws about that. But the Trump administration came in and I would say, generally speaking, is a bit more deregulatory, but it's not a dramatic shift for artificial intelligence. And they've continued leaning in to being restrictive on exports, which actually started in Trump 1.0 against Huawei, a large Chinese technology company. President Biden leaned even further into export controls. And I would say that President Trump is there as well. So you'd say, what's different? There's a lot of big narratives, big talk supporting artificial intelligence from this administration. And mind you, they're using it as a geopolitical negotiating chip with Mideast nations and even with China. But by and large, it's a bit deregulatory, less concerned about responsible AI, and yet still pretty tough on export controls to China.
He came out with an AI action plan within the first 6 months. What was in the AI action plan? What was it for?
Multiple questions. What is it for? It's ultimately, like many doctrines of this by Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives in Europe and elsewhere, it's a bit of a message document. It's a political document. We are for something and we're against something, and revs up news stories and podcasts like this. When you ask what it's for, I am and have lived in the political world. But the substance of it was a pro-American AI policy, fitting in with the overall president's view of America first, or so-called making America great again. And so in that context, going lighter touch on regulation, lighter touch on the ethics, bias, and fairness, and privacy issues around AI, leaned heavily into saying that we should be supportive of data center and infrastructure development, and make less sand in the gear to development. And it did speak to some of these issues around export control and having an American first policy. Interesting for those European listeners, it also, as Vice President Vance had in an earlier speech in Munich, said to Europe, we think you've been too restrictive in these areas, too regulatory. So here was the US in the AI action plan speaking to Europe. And then again, in December of 2025, they spoke to Europe again. And the U.S. publishes this thing called the National Strategic Strategy once a year. But the first year a president does it, it really speaks loudly to the world. And boy, did President Trump speak loudly towards the end of 2025 on a lot of things, but in part was about artificial intelligence, that the U.S. needs to be first amongst this push and this technology.
The impact of AI is something that Gary's colleagues at MIT have had a lot to say about on Vox Talks over the years. We spoke to David Otor on automation and the value of expertise in July 2025. And in June 2023, we also spoke to Daron Acemoglu about Power and Progress, the book he wrote on the influence of technology on society with his colleague, Sivan Johnson. Find these episodes and much more on the influence of AI when you subscribe to Vox Talks wherever you get your podcasts.
So let's look at how he's intending to be first. Now, those exports that you talked about, the export strategy, it's been pretty tough on what can be exported to other countries, particularly China. What are the restrictions here? How strong are they at the moment?
President Trump, in his first term, had already put some restrictions on technological exports to some Chinese companies, Huawei being the lead. President Biden broadened that out and had a three-tier process where some nations like China would get very little, if anything. Some nations were in the middle. And then the top tier were allies. I would say President Trump's plan has looked at all of this in a more transactional way, a part of a tool set for this administration to use to achieve other geopolitical goals. As it relates to China, it's still pretty tough restrictions. Some of the leading chip manufacturers like NVIDIA have pressed hard that they want to be able to sell their middle-tier chips to China. At first, early in 2025, the president's team said no. NVIDIA took a big $5 billion write-off on that because they couldn't sell the chips to China. Then the president said, well, yes, maybe these lower-tier H20 chips can go. And then, interestingly, the Chinese government said to their major state enterprises and even private enterprises, not so fast. Maybe we don't want you to be buying these NVIDIA chips. And I know people like the game of soccer. The ball keeps bouncing back and forth. And of course, China has a dominance, 90 plus market share dominance on a really important piece of the supply chain called rare earths.
Yeah.
More importantly, the refining and processing of rare earths, even more importantly, the magnets. And so China also exerted that economic leverage. So we are now in a world of competing interest using economic leverage to extract that from other countries. And the U.S. is doing that to Europe in a more broad way. But interestingly, on AI, when the president went in 2025 to the Middle East, he also decided in the spring, well, maybe I'll relieve some of the stress here. I'll allow more chips to go to key Middle Eastern countries as part of an overall negotiation. But was it a negotiation to promote AI? Presumably, yes. Or was it a negotiation that maybe ended up with a multiple $100 million airplane being gifted to the U.S.? It's all part of a broader tactical transactional presidency.
You've been inside government, Gary, when you're looking at some of these deals that are being made around AI technology, and of course, famously now, NVIDIA's paying 15% to the government of its sales of H20 chips in China.
And the Chinese government has said, not so fast, we don't want to buy as many.
We don't want to buy it now.
Yes.
Yeah. Is it all about doing the next deal, the next thing along, making a small advantage?
I think it's accurate to say that every leader in probably history has a mixture of strategy and tactics.
Mm-hmm.
Or one might say strategy and transactions. This presidency really does pride itself on its transactional approach.
Yeah.
And so I think that a lot of what's going on in artificial intelligence does fit strategy. There is a broad strategy of this administration, and I would say even the prior administration, the Biden administration, to support chip development in the United States. President Biden had a big bill that went through the U.S. Congress to do just that and support it. It was bipartisan. A big strategy to support AI development in the U.S. But I think there's a transactional overlay that is even more significant in this administration about these deals, whether it's in the Middle East or even with China, as we saw when the two presidents met last year and President Xi and President Trump came away with a one-year truce on the restriction on rare earths and the U.S.'s very elevated tariffs. Two great nations are holding the proverbial guns to each other's head, and they each say, well, all right, we'll back away from that. But the U.S. still left very large tariffs on China, and China is still trying to build their resiliency. China has a remarkable capability. Their computer scientists are fabulous, and they have more of them than Europe or the U.S. just because of the sheer size of China, but also because of their educational system, their culture. This is not China of the 1990s or even of the 2010s. They are really the world's hegemon. And I will repeat, the world's hegemon when it comes to rare earths, electronic vehicles, solar panels, magnets. The U.S. is definitely the world's hegemon in terms of a deep and liquid capital markets, hegemon in terms of the U.S. dollar. We're really are the most innovative economy and culturally the support of finance for that innovation. But no one should count the Chinese out.
Let's have a look at how AI is being used domestically. Your colleagues at MIT are leading the debate. We've spoken to David Otor. We've spoken to Daron Acemoglu. What is very clear is we don't quite know yet exactly what effect it might have on domestic productivity. Where do you stand on this?
Thank you for quoting two remarkable colleagues, Simon Johnson, who won the Nobel Prize with Daron, and Simon, my co-editor of books that we put out in 2025 about the economic consequences of the Trump administration with CEPR. And there's a range of views. One of my former colleagues at MIT, Eric Brynjolfsson. Eric is in the end of the spectrum where he foresees about 2.5% productivity point gain over 10 years. So this is a 10-year window, not all in 1 year, about 2.5 points. Daron is around 0.3% over 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's a wide range. And David Alter is a little bit more positive than Daron. Simon is closer maybe to them. I find myself in the middle. University of Pennsylvania has an estimate out late in 2025, about 1.5% productivity points in the next 10 years. Here's the question. We already have in San Francisco and in Austin, Texas, and elsewhere, significant portion of ride hailing. You're hailing a Waymo,
mm-hmm.
an autonomous vehicle to take you around town. How many years is it before the entire ecosystem of taxis are moved over? What about the 2 to 2.5 million Americans that work in trucking? So there's going to be big transformations over the next 2 to 3 decades, maybe not the next 2 or 3 years, of labor. And what we found in the past, whether it was the canal era 200 years ago, the railroad era 150 years ago, electricity and the automobile 100 years ago, or the internet 30 years ago. In each of these eras, there's big disruptions, big waves of transformation, and economies change. I think we're in one of those eras. So I'm more optimistic than Daron and David, but I look, Daron won the Nobel. I didn't. So
No,
that's not my path. But I do appreciate that to the extent that it's just about automation, it doesn't boost productivity. It just displaces folks. Here's the two things. What happens to the people that no longer are in those roles, the truck drivers or the office workers? What else are they doing productively in society, producing goods and services that we humans actually want to consume? Mm-hmm. And two, and this is where the big question mark is, what does it do beyond automation? Because every general purpose technology in the past, electricity, the automobile, the internet, so forth, its real boost of productivity came not from automation alone, but from what it does to transform an economy.
And is the Trump administration in its policies doing anything to deal with these effects?
This administration is deeply into what they would call individual sovereignty and national sovereignty, and stepping away from supporting either countries or individuals. There's a unified theme in this. I would say they're leaning in to be a ultimate booster in chief for the technology, but far less in terms of what it means for the working public.
It's the one thing that I really wanted to ask you about because of your experience is the AI bubble that everyone's worrying about at the moment. There is a lot of market concentration in the sorts of technologies that are producing AI. Is the administration worried about the level of concentration?
I can't speak for the administration and what they think about. I had the great honor to be in government when I was not supposed to speak about the markets. But here I find myself, I'm not in government.
And you can.
And I guess I can. Unambiguously, artificial intelligence in 2025 boosted the U.S. GDP growth. Just in the first half of 2025, J.P. Morgan estimated that it was well more than half of economic growth. But here's the catch. It's not about AI productivity. It's about capital expenditures on all those data centers and buying all those NVIDIA and AMD and TSMC chips. We definitely have a boom going on. And even if these accelerated higher spending on capital expenditure infrastructure just flatlines, which is approximately $400 billion a year, which is well over 1.25% of US GDP, even if it flatlines, you're taking away an accelerant of growth. If it reverses itself, it dampens the economy. Here's the second thing about it. The revenues don't currently cover those expenditures.
Yeah.
Look at OpenAI just for one example. For all of 2025, and while it's not a public company, but for all of 2025, it's estimated it might be somewhere in the vicinity of $12 or $13 billion of revenues. And it's making commitments, a company that's probably had a negative cash flow in 2025 of 20-ish billion. It's making commitments, not just in the hundreds of billions, but add it all up and say closer to $1 trillion.
Yeah.
Now, don't get me wrong. It's ambitious. It's bold.
We could definitely say that.
But will it play out? So now back to the stock market. Unambiguously, there's a disequilibrium. The spending on AI is boosting the economy, and it could be about $400 billion a year. Direct revenues matching that might be $50 billion. Somewhere that disequilibrium has to right itself. There's an awful lot of concentration that you said, that the largest players in the market have the largest market share, not just in the stock market, but in this ecosystem of artificial intelligence. And thirdly, in the stock market, these companies are driving. The U.S. stock market rounded out in early December was about $70 trillion. The European total stock market, $15 trillion. This is not about American exceptionalism alone. I mean, I do think that U.S. economy is quite strong and unique, but it's also about valuations.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about concentration, the top four, the NVIDIA, Microsoft, and Alphabet and Amazon, in aggregate, those four companies are worth all of the entire European stock market. You kind of go, what's a buy and what's a sell? And I'm not giving investment advice, but I think the one big difference from prior booms around general purpose technology, railroads of the mid 19th century, automobile, radio, and electricity in the 1920s, the internet of the 1990s, you can study each of these and they don't end well in terms of stock markets, whether it's the 1870s or 1990s. It's fascinating history. A debt fed bubble, like the 2008 financial crisis, housing bubble, those end really hard. This boom or bubble, if you wish, is much more equity fed, and the big concentrated tech platforms that have a lot of free cash flow. Where my worry is part of the U.S. economic growth will go away, even if the capital expenditure is just flatlined. The stock market valuations themselves are supporting a lot of the spending, particularly of the high net worth and the ultra net worth.
Yeah.
The U.S. economy right now is not being supported by the average median family's consumption. The third thing I do worry about is there's a fair amount of debt building up in the AI ecosystem around the interconnectedness between NVIDIA and others providing supply chain financing to the model makers. And remember, the model makers are just leasing the chips and the big data centers rush to build all these data centers.
It's very interconnected, isn't it?
History tells us when you have problems in finance, it's usually around debt, interconnectedness, a lack of transparency, and complexity. Those four together, if any one of them gets knocked over, the chair falls in that four-legged stool. So what you have here is a lot of this interconnectedness. You have debt into some of these neo-cloud companies like CoreWeave and others. We don't have revenues yet to support this. Now, maybe OpenAI's revenues will go up tenfold in the next few years, but what if it only goes up threefold? And so you have this wobbly system, and I think that's a real risk.
We're 4 for 4 on your measures of risk.
I don't have a number. Thank you, Tim, for trying to get that out of me. I'm just saying that in the system, you have some very strong, relatively low debt companies like the Microsofts and the Googles and so forth. And in China, the very big tech companies, they're not debt heavy. If the values come down significantly, those companies will survive. The risk area is some of these second-tier cloud companies. They're generally called neo-cloud companies. Some of the model developers that have committed to lease chips down the future. I think it's the public itself. When the economy slows down, if the valuations come off.
Gary, thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you want to read Gary's chapter on AI, and much more, of course, then download the book, The Economic Consequences of the Second Trump Administration, a preliminary assessment from CEPR.org. It's a free download, and there will be a link in the show notes.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next time on Vox Talks Economics, has AI eaten the economics major?